Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking about a book by Peter F. Hamilton. It's his latest publication, A Night Without Stars, a novel of the Commonwealth. Just before I start this, I do want to announce a cool new feature that you can find on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast website. Up until now, I've often talked about like the episode list there, and so if you're wondering, has Luke reviewed this book before? Shall I recommend this book to Luke to review? You can check if I've reviewed something, even if it's no longer in the podcast feed, because iTunes only has the latest 150 episodes or something in the feed. Whatever, however that works there, so you can't always go back and find just by searching through the feed. But the episode lists are right there. And before now, you've always been able to sort by the episode number and the book name and the author name, but now I've made it so I spent a few hours entering all the series information, so you can now search for series. And you can see here the first book that comes up is Academy number 2, which is Deep Six by Jack McDevitt, Across Real Time number 1, The Peace War by Verna Vinge, Alcatraz number 1, Alcatraz and the Evil Librarians by Brandon Sanderson. So you can search that one. And when I looked at this, I realized that the Commonwealth Saga is actually just the first two books in Peter F. Hamilton's book. It's the Pandora's Star and Judas and Changewit, and it comes up there, Commonwealth Saga. And then there's the Void Trilogy, which is also part of the Commonwealth Saga. And I would have put Commonwealth Saga Void number 1, 2, and 3, but what I've done is I've stuck with the series names and the series numbering from the Goodreads.com book list. So this one says Commonwealth, Chronicle of the Fall is number 2, whereas The Void is just as Void number 1, 2, and 3. So I've used it that way. So if you're wondering, hey, why are you using, this name or that numbering system, I'm just going by the numbering system and names of the series from Goodreads.com. And so that information is going to be in podcast titles from now on, I guess, if it's part of a series. So check out your current podcast player, and you might even see Commonwealth Chronicle of the Fall at the end of this podcast episode. So anyway, go over to sfbrp.com, click on the episode lists link, and explore the series. And there's actually quite a lot of books that I found which I didn't realize were part of series, because maybe when I read them they were just a standalone book, or most people only ever read the first book in a series. But there was quite a few that I found as like, oh, that's actually got more books with that, I guess, maybe just in that universe or with those characters or whatever. And other books which I just presumed were standalone novels or first books in this series, turns out they're actually the fourth book. It says here, The Sky So Big and Black by John Barnes. Didn't know that was part of the series, but it's actually The Century Next Door, book number 4. But I guess that's kind of like maybe a world, just sort of like a universe where all of these books are kind of set in that book. So in that universe, the Century Next Door series. So, and also when like the culture series that I read, me and Juliana, when we read through them, we went by my preferred numbering or reading order. But again, just using the ones that are there, the publication order is generally what I've used here from the from Goodreads.com. So anyway, let's get on to today's book. This is, like I say, the second book in the series, or maybe the seventh book in a series, depending on which way round, which series you want to do. If it's part of the whole Commonwealth Saga, it's book number 7. So we've had a lot of time with this world, and a lot of time with the characters some of the characters that appear in this book. You got the Pandora's Star, your Judas and Change, your Void Trilogy, and then, actually, let me go back to that page again, Commonwealth, Chronicle of the Fall is number 1, The Abyss Beyond Dreams. Now, in my head, I didn't think I enjoyed that book very much, because I guess mostly what I remember about it is the things that I didn't like about the book. But looking here, I gave it a 3.5 stars, which I think is just a testament to Peter F. Hamilton's storytelling, even if the ending of his stories are generally not very good, not very satisfying, and some of the story of that one wasn't there. He's just good enough at the characters and good enough at the action and the intrigue and aliens and technology, just to make it a fun, space opera read. In that book, if you've read the Void Trilogy, it turns out there's something in the middle of the galaxy which has got this, it's kind of a big, it's kind of the manifold in space, a big singularity or whatever, which is consuming stars to power something which is, revealed in that Void Trilogy to be kind of like a world where anything is possible. It's kind of a programmatic digital, but not digital, but some kind of world where you can actually enter into the void and live in there. And there's kind of a fantasy world, I think it was called Macathran or whatever it was in there, and and weird stuff would happen there, and people had kind of like magical abilities, but technology wouldn't work, maybe because if it is a big simulation inside, it's not possible to, simulate the high technology. So the technology is kind of replaced by magic. Anyway, that all plays out in the Void trilogy. And then at the start of the Chronicle of the Fallers, we get two main characters from that series and two of the main characters from the Commonwealth saga. And at the start of that book, it's Nigel, I think it's Nigel Sheldon, who is one of the main characters in that first trilogy, and Paula Mayo, and they are kind of going, oh right, there's we years ago before this happened, we actually sent someone into the void. I'm getting mixed up now with the Abyss Beyond Dreams. So he sent someone into the void, and actually it was like a clone of Nigel Sheldon who went in there. But instead of landing on the planet of Macathran, he instead landed on the planet of Bienvenido. Maybe I'm not getting this pronunciation right, but there's a planet, Bienvenido, and so he lands there, and actually the rules of that planet are different, you know. There's still some kind of like a weird mix of some kind of fantasy elements and science fiction elements, but the government is completely different, society is completely different. It's like if you're landing on Macathran, and it's more of like, you know, kind of a more of a classic fantasy one, but that kind of felt like, you know, Macathran kind of felt more like Renaissance level of technology. Bienvenido felt more like Industrial Revolution level of technology. And there's much more of a memory of like, okay, this spaceship arrived and crash landed here, and the captain set up a new world, or the captain set up a new political regime, and we are living in it. So there's not that much of a long distance. There's only maybe a few generations. Well, I mean, the people in these books are quite long lived, but say there's like 20 or 30 generations going back to who remembers the captain's generation when this spaceship first landed on this planet. And of course the technology on the spaceship started failing quite quickly, and they had to kind of reset civilization. It's slowly been bumbling along. At the end of the first book, in this duo of books, this Abyss Beyond Dreams, there is a way that Nigel Sheldon seems to kind of bust the planet out of the void. And but unfortunately, because whoever is in charge of the void seems to go, any kind of species or any planet or any kind of anything that comes into the void, which is a little bit annoying, we're going to cast out, but we're not going to put them back in the normal galaxy because they're obviously too dangerous. We're going to orbit them around this star in intergalactic space, just in the middle of nowhere, between galaxies, actually. And so that sets up this book here. This planet has been cast out of the void, and technology is working again, and the magic isn't working again. But when they look up at night, there are no stars, and they're in the abyss beyond, between galaxies, and they are now in the, they have nights without stars. That's the idea. So this book is kind of like a follow-on from that. In the first book, Nigel Sheldon, one of the characters that we know from Pandora's Star, etc., he has an adventure on that planet of Bienvenido. And then we find out at the beginning of this book that he actually took a little version of Paula Mayo along with him in cloned embryo form. And so he goes, well, if anything goes wrong and I need some kind of diplomatic solution, we'll wake you up. Anyway, that plan didn't really work out. However, at the start of this book, that plan is kind of delayed a lot, but is kicked into gear. So this book is pretty much Paula Mayo's turn to have an adventure on a planet, this time not in the void and without any magic, but with the same similar problems that Nigel Sheldon was dealing with in that first book. However, in that first book in this series, the Abyss Beyond Dreams, what I didn't like about it was that it kind of had a plot which revolved around some people being a bit stupid and not really being in control of things. And I was always like, why are these people being stupid? But of course it was revealed that Nigel Sheldon was doing mind control to manipulate people to do stuff, but it still didn't feel any more satisfying realizing that people were doing stupid stuff because they were manipulated into doing the stupid stuff, rather than, you know, it was like just bad plotting or bad characterization. So that whole, the whole thrust of the novel and what they were doing or what they were achieving was kind of let down for me in that book, and that's one of my main memories of that book. However, in this book, there isn't that situation. There is, unfortunately, A small problem with Peter F. Hamilton books is that he's not very good at ending stories. Most of his big stories, these big space operas, end with somebody discovering a big, dumb, well, not a big, dumb object, but a big thing in the universe somewhere, which has so much power that someone just kind of, you know, is granted godlike abilities to go, right, now I'm going to sort this out and sort that out and sort this out and sort this out, and everyone has a happy ending, or at least there is an ending for all these people. This is solved and that's solved over there. It's not like that in all of his books, but it's almost, you know, it's notable when it isn't, when there isn't just this big, dumb object deus ex machina coming up at the end of the movie where somebody goes, can we fix all this? Yeah, we can. Why? Well, it's because I have now ultimate power in this part of the universe or this part of the galaxy, and now I'm going to fix everything. And you're like, okay, great, I guess, if we're having that. This book does have kind of half of that problem. Don't want to give away too much, but at least it just doesn't happen immediately and instantly at the end of the book. It's like, oh, this'll work. Boom, everything's sorted out. It's much more of a, like a building up. It's like the characters are going, right, if we get here and get there and find that thing, that's the key to this thing. That MacGuffin will open this thing. We need this person to do that and do that. And if we put all these things together, we might be able to, you know, get back in contact with the Commonwealth or, you know, whatever the plans are to solve the problems. And so it is kind of like, foreshadowed a bit more that that's what they're aiming for, rather than in some of his other books where they just go, right, big dumb object. So along the way, it wasn't just like stuff is happening, solution. It's like, there's a solution over there. Now we've got to do all of this stuff to reach that solution. So this is actually a much more satisfying story than the first book in this series, The Abyss Beyond Dreams, and has a more satisfying conclusion than others. What I do like about this book is that maybe Nigel Sheldon, I just don't like Nigel Sheldon very much. I don't like I never found him interesting as a main character in any of those books. So when he became like the main or one of the main protagonists and the driving forces of the story in The Abyss Beyond Dreams, I was like, really? Nigel Sheldon? We're going with him? Like all the characters that we could pick from the Void trilogy and the Commonwealth saga with Pandora Star and Jews and Jews, we're going to go for him? Okay. And then we stuck with it. And then this, it's more like, oh, and now we're going to get a Paula Mayo clone she's going to use her abilities and insights and all that kind of stuff, and she's going to be one of the main characters in this book. I wouldn't say she is the main character, but as she comes more and more into the story, she does take more and more control, and you're like, okay, I see where this is going. And it's just much more fun to spend time with someone who is like a bit more developed and has got a more memorable backstory and is more memorable, rather than just being, oh, this person is a science genius who uses science genius to become one of the richest and most powerful men in the galaxy. And you're like, really? Is that the person? It's more like, oh, this is a cloned from some kind of, you know, Aldous Huxley inspired colony where everyone is brought up and genetically manipulated into being the perfect person. She was a detective. She was the perfect detective on this, but she was kidnapped when she was a child and was brought up in the Commonwealth as a detective. And you're like, okay, this is a character who has got a little bit more going on than just rich billionaire science guy. And so it was more fun to spend time with her and to see how she would deal with not the same problem, but similar problems to what Nigel dealt with in the first book here in this Chronicle of the Fallers, which brings me on to the Fallers. What is the Fallers? Chronicle of the Fallers. Well, the Fallers are this around the planet of Bienvenido. There's like this band of what they call trees in the book, and these trees are kind of some spaceships which had these a genetically mutating copying alien. So these eggs would fall down onto the planet, and then they would subsume the pinnacle of evolution, like the apex predators, the biggest animals, and then they would kind of replicate them with their memories and stuff, and then spit out a kind of like a body snatcher version of the human or other animal that had been subsumed into the eggs. And these are called the Fallers, and they are very dangerous because they are trying to take over the planet. And in this book, in the first book, we dealing with them, and we thought, oh, if we get out of the void, those won't be around anymore. It turns out, well, they are still there, and they're more powerful. And the magic that was used when this planet was inside the void doesn't work anymore, so they're harder to detect, and lots of other issues. And then some of the bad guys from the Pandora Star. What do you call the Morning Light Mountain Lakeside guy? I can't believe this has dropped out of my head now. What's the name of motiles. No, motis are something else. Whatever they are, the aliens from the Pandora star they turn up as well, or there's some backstory where they've turned up around this, because this planet has been cast out to a place where all the problematic species are. So there's not just the Bienvenido now orbiting the star, all the other problematic races of aliens that ever entered the void are going, oh, can't deal with these guys, let's chuck them out and orbit them around that star in the middle of interstellar space and leave them to do what they need to do. So there are more aliens, other problematic aliens that have been chucked out of the void, but the Fallers are the most problematic, and it's pretty much set up at the start of this book that destroying the Fallers and sending rockets into space to destroy the trees with nuclear weapons is one of the main efforts, and to track down the Fallers is like the main effort. So the characters that we follow in this book is one of the main characters is Rai Evine. Again, I'm just going by the audiobook that I listened to, the pronunciations from there. So Rai Evine is an astronaut who gets shot into space and takes out one of these trees and does some stuff there as well. And then you've got Chang and Jennifer and some other people who they are like detectives and policemen whose job it is, I think they're in Section 7 or whatever it is, and they are there to track down Faller nests and try and work out who the Fallers are and to kill them. And so we have some action with those two messing around there as well. The other main character, I guess, is Florian, and he is a park ranger, and once he finds this sleeper like medical capsule that drops out of the sky, and there's this great line where this medical capsule, which has got like somebody's I think it's Jimmy his name is or whatever, some kind of Commonwealth citizens memory bank stored in there, and they're like, okay, he says, right, Florian, the fate of every human on the planet depends on how you answer these questions over the next minute. And I'm like, okay, this is where the plot really kicks into gear, and it does. And of course, what is in that thing? It's a baby. And who is that baby? I'm sure, like, because right at the very beginning of the book, there, like, it's Paula and Maya and Nigel going, hey, well, I'll come along with you in embryo form. So when the baby turns up, you're like, okay, this is Paula Meyer. But of course, the characters don't know who it is or what she's capable of and what technology she has in her body and things like that. So we have Paula Meyer as well in baby form. And that first part of this book is about what do they do? What does Florian do with a baby when they're thinking it's a Faller, or what's going on? Now, there are some different factions on this planet. Not everyone's getting on quite well, because not only are there humans and Fallers, but there's also the Advancer humans, or I think they're called elitists in this book, which are people with Commonwealth technology still in their brains, and they can communicate with each other using the Commonwealth technology and some other bits and pieces. They live longer, they can regulate their lifespan. And this is like a minority population on the planet. And Florian and some other characters are this. And there's also the Warrior Angel, who is someone who was in the first book, who got a lot more Commonwealth technology, and she's kind of helping to lead the resistance against the very kind of dystopian, domineering, totalitarian government, which is cracking down both on elitists, these Advancer people, and also the Fallers as well. So that's the whole setup, and it just sets up, and it's like, okay, this character over here, this character doing this person is trying to catch this person, but we think that they're both kind of meant to be good guys and girls, but we're not quite sure who we're rooting for. Oh, we're rooting for this person. And these people, you know, run across each other and meet up with each other and hunt each other down, and, you know, and this person's working with that person, then they're working with this person. I just really enjoyed like the setup to this novel. Again, it's kind of, for the length of the book it is, it's kind of simple, but you get rockets going into space and fights with aliens and underground stuff and kind of like the kind of noir thing. Oh, and then I went in here and I tracked down that, and the police procedural stuff, which I like from Peter F. Hamilton's books, especially like Great North Road. We've got the police procedural stuff. We've got like, you know, advanced technologies and clashing of advanced technologies and less advanced technologies. And yeah, overall, gates, you know, they have some gates technology and some other, you know, portal, you know, kind of technology and other technology from the Commonwealth, which is quite fun as it's coming into kind of like a cross between an industrial revolution level technology. And they're trying to push through the industrial age and through up the information age and the space age. And it's all these different things because the weird situation that this planet is in and the different influence of technology that they have, historical technology and other technology, which is like Commonwealth Commonwealth influence and other stuff from different planets and different alien technologies filtering in there all the time. So it's a fun planetary romance in a way, in the same way that you get like a Barsoom novel where you get someone just turning up on a planet and they're like an alien, or John Carter turns up on Mars. And it's sort of like there's a mixture of guns and knives and lasers and spaceships, but also airships and sailing ships and, you know, all these different mismatch of levels of technology. This is kind of like a knowing nod to that kind of planetary romance kind of setup. Also some fun, you know, like I say, some fun space exploration in like Soyuz level, Soyuz launch and capsule return level space technology and gates and stuff like that. So all of that kind of stuff is actually really good fun mix of levels of technology, and somehow it works because, you know, there's always has to be an enemy which makes it difficult for the main characters if they're like advancers. Like, well, who are they fighting against? And all the time they're the fallers. There's this kind of like a prediction, like a half science, a scientific prediction, half kind of prophetic prediction, half kind of political propaganda prediction of the faller apocalypse. Like, once so many fallers have actually dropped down from the sky and they get their numbers up past this tipping point level, they'll be able to just wipe out all the humans, and this will be a faller world. So, yeah, some good stuff going in there. So, yeah, let me go through some of my notes. My notes that I made on my phone was, yeah, the fate of every human on the planet depends on how you answer these questions over the next minute. Also, what happens in a month? I really like this kind of thing. It's like, it'll only take a month. What happens in a month? If you've read this book, you'll understand that. There's some good underworld stuff. Again, it all felt very familiar in a way. Like, as you're reading this book, you're going, okay, so this is a planet which has been a fantasy planet and then been cast here as well. Like, how close to our real world, our current world, or the world as it was in the 1930s or in the 1960s or in the 1980s, or like, what is this? What is the analog here? But I think it works because even though everything in this book feels quite familiar, like the turns of phrase, it's like, yeah, this is translated from future speak into this via a fantasy world and a science fiction world. So I think if this book was kind of more, like, if the world building had been more extreme and more out there, it wouldn't have just worked as a fun adventure romp. Like, these people are chasing these people have got to escape, and what happens now? Well, there's a chase, and this happens, and that happens, there's a car crash, and there's more stuff, and there's airships, and there's spaceships, and, you know, there's battles, and people on the run. That wouldn't work if it was kind of a more elaborate science fictional world with like more different rules and different setups and different characters. It was quite handy just to have these setups and worlds kind of immediately familiar from other science fiction and other fiction and movies and stuff, and you could just go, right, now we're going to do this kind of scene. And I'm like, you know what, I'm good with that. Let's go with it. Let's run with this. So that's good fun. There is a section where they travel to the southern continent of Bienvenido, and they go pretty much to Bienvenido's Antarctica, and they're sailing down there, and they're doing this, and they're getting to the ice shelves. I happen to be listening to the audiobook of this while sailing in Antarctica. I went there on a work trip on my last trip. This has actually been about 2 weeks since I finished this book, so I'm remembering back through looking at these notes. It's just really good fun to listen to an audiobook kind of set on, you know, other planet Antarctica while in Antarctica. You should check out my YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/Luke Burridge and check out my Antarctica vlogging. You can see me juggling Antarctica. I talk about visiting there, and see me swimming in a pool in Antarctica, being naked in Antarctica. It's quite fun. Mostly naked in Antarctica. Juggling with freezing balls is, I think, the title of that vlog. I think you'll enjoy that as well, so check that out. Anyway, what else do I have to say? My other notes are Chang and Jennifer -really? There are some problematic characters in this book. I'm not saying problematic as in that, like, they're problematically written. It's just sort of like they are problems in the book. And sometimes I was thinking, okay, what do these two characters, Chang and Jennifer, it's like, okay, this is a troubled relationship. And there's always a thing that's in the back of my head from a past experience in my life, unfortunate experience, which is don't put your dick in the crazy girl. And I was just like kind of like singing that song that I wrote about that situation in my head. It's not the most politically correct song or but it's one of those things I'm just going, no, this is obviously the crazy girl. Like, I've never, of course there's crazy guys as well, but that's not what I've experienced. And I'm like, is Peter F. Hamilton getting something out here? Is this a character? Like, who is Jennifer in his life? Did he have a crazy ex-girlfriend in his life, which was like bad news from the start and is getting it out? So there is a little bit of that story, which I kind of felt a bit uncomfortable with, like a little bit problematic with, especially how it's kind of resolved in the end. I was like, oh, it could have been, better, but overall, that's it. What are the notes that I have here? Oh yeah, last book was Nigel having fun on a magic planet. Now it's Paula's turn. Those are all my notes. Okay, well, let's have a look on goodreads.com. Let's see if, I'm not connected to the internet, but let's see if this page is still there on my phone. Is it? I did one of the reading offline things. Oh no, satellite internet login didn't work. Oh, that's a pity. So I can't look up what it says about this on, or what other people say. So my review of this is 4 stars. What else did it say here? Night Without Stars. Yeah, average rating is 4.44 stars. But I think what happens is that at the end of these series, I've noticed this on other series and other podcasts as well, is that when you get to book 7 in a series, like people who really don't like Peter F. Hamilton or The Commonwealth or the first book in the series, all of those people are kind of out at this point. So when you get to book 7 in a series, it's always going to be above 4 stars because you don't get to... Or maybe it could be like in one of those like long running series like the Vorkosigan saga, a book comes out and you're like, and everyone agrees, oh, you know what, this just isn't as good. But one of these kind of like main sequence series, it's gonna be the fans of this book who read it and review it first, and it's gonna bump up to 4.44 stars, which is actually very highly rated, a highly rated book here on Goodreads. I'm going to give it 4 stars. I did enjoy it more than that. But again, it's Peter F. Hamilton. It's like, he's just a solid writer. It's just so easy just to go with this. I was like, you know what? There isn't going to be a spelling mistake in the first line. There's not going to be problematic, plotting in a way which, you know, that might be reflected in some of the previous books. I'm not reading somebody's first novel attempt. There's not going to be all those amateur mistakes in there. It's just going to be solid characters with solid storytelling, with solid science fiction, space opera, planetary adventure. That's what I want from Peter F. Hamilton, and that's what I got with this book. Like I say, it's a little bit of a step up from the other one. What else do I want to say? Yeah, normally I have like a format where I've talked about the characters and the world and the plotting and the story and the technology and things. Normally I talk about the themes, but it's one of those books which, like, when this book was written, it's about like people. Again, not wanting to get too political, but this is a book which is about politics in a way. It's about living under a tyrannical government. And it's kind of a pity that this, there's easy comparisons to make between this book and other books. But the thing is, when you're actually looking at these books, which are like, oh, this is a tyrannical government, but this tyrannical government, you can see that people are self-serving about it. But also, there is literally an alien species invading, and there is an apocalypse, and they're having to deal with, you know, this kind of uprising, and there's, you know, all these different mismatch of technology, and they're trying to control the world and do all that kind of stuff. And it's kind of, I know it's weird to say this, but like, compared to our world at the moment and with Trump and Brexit and rise of the far right, I'm just like, it's so annoying to read books like this because you think, oh, I want to draw comparisons, but there's not really comparisons to draw because the world actually at the moment is pretty safe for everyone. It's pretty good. And sure, some, you know, there are issues of this and issues of that, but generally everything's getting better. And you kind of go, well, why are people aiming for like kind of more fascist totalitarian? Why are people going farther right in these kind of ways when everything's getting better anyway? And actually the problems in the future are going to be bad, but they're going to be, you know, it's going to be tricky. Like, if suddenly someone comes into power and says, right, I'm going to be a complete tyrant, but I'm going to save the world from, you know, climate change stuff and sea level rising, so I'm just going to start dictating, I'm just going to take over government and take over, you know, and stop people traveling. But the reason why they can't travel isn't because they're Muslims or they come from these countries. It's like, yeah, we're just not going to do long distance air travel anymore, just to give the skies a little break from all the carbon dioxide it spews out. And we're not going to do this anymore. And just like, you know, it's one of those kind of things that when there is a, when there is a, like a political, like, well, no, sort of like an external threat that comes in, you can kind of go, oh, well, I understand why this information was suppressed and these people were put in, you know. I, again, I'm not apologizing for any of this thing. I think these things can be, you know, these problems can be solved otherwise. There doesn't have to be tyranny. But it's kind of like in a book like this, or in a book about, oh, we're going to have this rebellion against this, there's almost always has to be, with for fiction to be believable, there always has to be a reason why the totalitarian government is in charge, be it a massive disaster or an alien invasion or this kind of thing. And you're like, okay, well, I kind of understand why those people are acting like this and making these decrees and just riding roughshod over, personal liberties and travel and religion and all these different kind of things and all the prejudice that comes up with these. You go, right, okay, disagree with all of that, but for the book to be believable, there has to be a reason for it. And what's kind of annoying about the real world at the moment is just like, no, actually, it's, yeah, sure, there's issues, but the issues don't need these things. It doesn't need these people to be elected. It doesn't need these, these decisions to be made in referendums. Like, why, like, we've had existential threats with, Second World War and well, I guess it's pretty much it for Europe and America. So like, it was like, yeah, we had those big things and we went through those kind of things and we solved that problem. I say we, the Nazis were defeated. And then after that, what did we do? We didn't just go, right, now let's do it. It's kind of like, no, like after the Second World War, they just went, right, okay, now let's have a Labour government. We that problem's solved, and now we've just got to look after the people at home and move on with it. And it's just like, that's kind of what we still are there, Even in a way, I could understand it would be, if it was like, oh, 9/11, blah, 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 now let's have this strong man person. In a way, that's even that is more believable or understandable rather than just the craziness that seems to be going on in America at the moment. It's just like, if this is bad fiction, like if Donald Trump and his generally the way that all the news that's kind of filtering through my little stick my fingers in my ears because I find this whole thing really depressing, it's not like, it would be bad fiction. It would be bad world building that Donald Trump would be there. It'd be okay in a satire book, but not in a serious book. You couldn't just have like that election take place and that person get into power and then do the kind of stupid, like trying to pass the laws that he's trying to bet. It would just be like, no, but there's no need. This isn't, nobody would be, why is going, what is, anyway. The whole thing is a bit of a pity because, like, as I was reading this book, I was like, oh, that's a bit like, and I was like, no, it isn't like that. It's actually more understandable. It's kind of more believable to be in a fiction book than it is in reality, which is a real problem. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to wrap up this with the obligatory Audible sponsorship spot. I might as well put this in because the Audible is quite a big book, actually. It was like, what, 20, 25 hours long or something like that? I don't even know, 27 hours? Big chunky book, well worth your time. If you want to get this book for free, A Night Without Stars, actually, get this book for free. If you've never tried Peter F. Hamilton, just go back and get Pandora's Star, which is the first book in this whole sequence. Pandora's Star, go get that one, and go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP. This book was narrated by John Lee, who he narrates quite a few of these Peter F. Hamilton books, and the... and many of the books, the Revelation Space books by Alastair Reynolds. He is a really good narrator. However, in a way, he's almost too good because now I kind of go, wait a second, is this a Peter? This book becomes a John Lee book for me as his narration is so good. And I can see what he's doing with the characters. I was like, oh, this character is like that character. I was like, oh, no, it's not. This character isn't like a character in Alastair Reynolds' book. It's just John Lee is doing like a similar voice technique or a similar accent technique. He's using this idea and bringing in this accent that you can do really well. And in some ways, because John Lee is such a good narrator, it becomes like I identify the books as his almost as much as I identify. Like the performance of this book is so much a big part of the enjoyment of it that, I really enjoyed it. And I kind of identify it as a John Lee book just as much as a Peter F. Hamilton book. Because it really does bring that amount of enjoyment. So if you want a free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And in that way, you get a free book and you help support me as a podcaster and my own reading habits and all the bits and pieces that I get up to here as well. So that's it from me. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm at Luke Burridge on Instagram. And you can follow my vlogging, my travel vlogging and juggling vlogging and other things. I recently did a review of my MacBook Pro, which I'm actually using now to record this podcast. If it sounds a bit different over the last few episodes of this podcast, it's because I'm not plugging any microphones because this microphone on this is good enough. So I don't plug in microphones or worry about that. I just talk into my laptop. It's not perfect. but this podcast is, I've never striven for good audio quality on this. I strive for good enough audio quality that I don't have to stress about doing a recording. So hopefully this is fine for everyone. Yeah, go over to youtube.com/Luke Burridge and you can check out my recent videos. Also sfbrp.com and click on episode lists and you can find all of these books that I review. Also now available to be sorted by series. So check it out. I'm quite proud of how that project went. It was actually less work than I thought it would be. And I was quite impressed by how many of the series and numbers I had from memory, but I'm good. It's good job that I did go through and check them, the majority of them, against the Goodreads lists and episode series. So if you see anything there, if you see any mistakes about it, please send me an email, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email that I got. It was good to hear back from Alan DeWitt, who has been a long-time listener. He's been listening to this podcast for probably 8 years now, 9 years. I don't know. How long have I been doing this? Yeah, since beginning of, wow, yeah, past 9 years of the Science Fiction Book Review podcast. So there's been some people who have been listening to this for almost as long as I've been recording it. So it's good to hear from everyone. I do, like I say, I do reply to every email that I get. luke@juggler.net, that's the email. And yeah, I think that's about it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.